August 27th, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for HPSDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I did a little bit of programming. I was working on some UDP communication protocols, and I was able to, I was playing a bit with multicasting, which is a different process than broadcasting, but very similar. And it's designed for identifying objects or UDP listeners within a subnet. So I figured that was a good protocol to be using. So made some progress, detects, it seems to work right. So have a bit of code that I can use. So that's it for me. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. I'm just catching up, both physically and with whatever it was I was doing before I left town. Been gone for a couple weeks, and trying to remember anything that was going on before that. Been off with family at excessive altitudes, and it's hard on a brain that doesn't do well with low oxygen.
Well, hopefully it was a fun trip, even if it was oxygen limited. Anyway, I did mention some of the things that you shared with me about the magnetometer and the potential of maybe the manufacturer was having some financial difficulties as well. So we'll see how that plays out. Next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK, shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak session or the TeamSpeak sessions to TeamSpeak Archive. tangerinesdr.com. Next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and also to Dave Witten. Welcome back, and glad you're here. Let's see. I got a lot of comments on the receiver requirements document. Phil and Nathaniel was kind enough to consolidate all of those from a bunch of folks into one document. So a lot of good stuff there. One or two questions to discuss and a little bit of rewriting of the spec to do. I also modified a noise source that is used on VHF and UHF so that it would operate down at HF and measured the noise figure of the Hermes board as along with the Alex filter. And so I think the estimates of noise figure and sensitivity that we have in the requirements document seem to be pretty close, so comfortable about that. Also sent some information to Scotty on clocking concepts on the clock module, and I see he put out a drawing here about 30 minutes ago, so hopefully he doesn't run into too much traffic on the way home and he can join the group tonight. And that's about it.
Well, fine business. And I see that we have Steve, 80AE, showing up in the other channel. Maybe he'll figure out how to get over to the Tangerine SDR channel. So he's at least another check-in here in a minute. And still no Scotty, which hopefully since he sent you an email, he's on his way home.
Yeah, I tried to drag Steve over onto this channel, but I don't have permission. Hang on, I'll go over to the default channel and ask Steve to come over here.
User left your channel. User entered your channel.
Well, Scotty, we're still in the roll call, so time for Scotty, WA2DFI. You get to tell us what you've been up to. We've already been through the list.
Oh, okay. Well, I was up to mowing the yard, and then I realized it was 6 o'clock, so I had to come inside and speak to you guys. Nice to see you, everyone. Thanks again, Dave, for running it in my laxitude of mowing the yard, trying to actually make it look like someone lives here. Anyways, this week I worked a bit on the clock scheme for the clock module, trying to figure out what the best way to do things is. And I got a really topic of discussion here, if someone hasn't brought it up already, on how we're going to synchronize multiple data engines. But and I did post a couple of diagrams to the Tangerine list. It again, in my usual last minute style, you know, about 4 o'clock, I think I posted them. So that's what I've been working on this week. Oh, and one other thing is I actually bought a set of connectors, and I'm going to do a mechanical mock-up out of just blank PC board to bring to DCC. So it'll be a little easier to visualize how the things are going to plug together. And hopefully if there's any problems with them plugging together, I can find it out before we go to layout. So it'll be interesting to see how that works. I'm just going to take copper clad, cut it and file it to where it'll plug into the connectors. There won't be any electrical, won't electrically work at all, but it'll be a mechanical sample. So it'll show how the boards stack up. So that's it for me. Back over to you, Dave.
One more question. Did you get your single board computer yet?
The VIM-3, I have not got it yet. No.
I know Dave is waiting on one too. Well, we're open. End of the roll call. I did call Steve, 80AE. Do you have any comments, Steve?
Hi, this is Steve. Hopefully this is working. All right. Hopefully this is working. Anyways, I just want to check in and say hi. The action we had this last week was Nathaniel and Phil and myself and Gareth all met, and we discussed the document you guys had moved over. So I think there's been some action on that as of late. I'm just trying to keep my head above water with the semester and getting papers moving. So that's my story these days. So I'm going to listen and try to take notes. I guess it's Nathaniel's wedding anniversary today, so I will sit in for him tonight. And Ethan's moving right now, so it's happy to help out.
Well, it is working, Steve, and I know where you are. I'm in my last semester, so I'm kind of enjoying it.
So, Dave, are you officially retired and working in retirement mode on your next teaching job for this fall semester?
The class has already started, but my official retirement date is the end of August. And as of September 1, I have emeriti status.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. So what does that do for you? I mean, what is that a good thing, or is it same responsibility but less pay?
Well, both. I get an email account and a few other little perks, and I am being paid for the rest of the semester to teach the classes. So it works out nice. I'm a little before I really was planning to stop, so it works out fine.
So you get some extra money to play radio with, right?
Well, I hope so.
Well, Dave, if you're like most retired folks, you'll end up being about three times as busy after you retire as before.
I am aware of that. I've noticed that happening. I'm being careful about what I, at least things that I say yes to are things that I enjoy.
Yeah, now you can be more discriminating in what you take on, right?
Well, I've had increased time to do programming, and that's been quite nice.
So, Tom, did you have a chance to look at that diagram at all? Or I know it's short notice as usual.
Yeah, I did. I got it about half an hour ago. And I've got the main clocking diagram up on the screen. I'm wondering if you can explain it to me.
Okay, let me get it up on my screen here. Okay, I got it up here. So the red box is the clock module. And the idea was to show all the clock paths, not any of the control paths or any of the feedback paths or anything like that, but just in general to show the flow of the clocks. The idea was to be able to support three configurations. One, a really base configuration that doesn't use anything on the clock module, just a dummy clock board. And then a configuration that uses a low-end clock board, or maybe I should say mid-grade clock board, something like. So the low-end one would be no clock because there's a clock on the main board. The mid-grade would be a VCXO that we could hook in with the FPGA and phase lock to a reference. And then the high end would be the GPSDO. So I'm trying to show how the clocks would flow. So each of those three configurations uses this diagram, this interconnect diagram, to send clocks and receive clocks.
Okay. So I think I've got that. And when you pull the GPSDO out and put in the dummy, it just bridges the clocks from the FPGA through over to the receivers.
Right. Because the idea is we have two clock inputs on each RF module, a oscillator input, and an FPGA from the FPGA input. And the from the FPGA input is less precise and less desirable than the oscillator inputs. And since they're on different pins, if you can't really feed, I mean, you can't expect the RF module to take the input on both clock pins. You're going to have to pick a set of pins. And actually, the ultimate reason to have two sets of pins on the RF module is one for the receiver and one for the transmitter, in case you're building a transceiver. So, because typically what we do on our boards is we run the receiver off of an oscillator, the A to D off an oscillator, and then the DAC we run off of an FPGA generated clock. So, at any rate, so you're right. The idea is, what I tried to do is I tried to start out so you could buy the DE board by itself. You wouldn't have to have anything else. You could plug an RF board in and you could run it. I just couldn't make that work without having jumper resistors on the DE. And if you did that, then you have multiple versions of the DE, because I don't want to require anybody to solder on the board. So, and all I'm really going to save by putting jumper resistors on the board is the cost of the clock connector, the M.2 connector, which is about $1. So it's really just not worth it to have a separate build, a separate SKU, just to have one that doesn't have the clock board on it, the clock connector on it. So I'm thinking, well, okay, put the clock connector on all of them. That's only $1. And then the low end one, you just have a little slug that is the bypass, and it routes the ins to the outs. And so we should be able to sell that really cheap, maybe even include it with the DE.
Okay, I think I got it. I was going to ask you why the FPGA clock went to the receiver, but it sounds like for a normal receiver, it probably would just not be utilized.
Right, wouldn't be utilized. And then in the case where you had only the oscillator on the board, what you could do then is you could actually have two different token clock modules, and you could have one feed the oscillator input of the RF modules with the oscillator, or you could actually feed it, because you notice there's an FPGA generated clock, there's two of them going into the clock module, so you could have a different bypass module that hooked those to the outs, to the oscillator outs, and then you could run the two RF modules from the FPGA, both ports from the FPGA, if you wanted to do that. So just to maximum flexibility.
Okay, I think I understand. This sounds very much like what we discussed last week, and the drawing is good. I think it makes it real clear. So I understand. It looks good.
Yeah, so take a look over on the left side. You see where I have RFM2?
Yes.
Well, that's going to be an MEC80, and that's going to accept our HF1, HF2, TX2 modules that we already have built. And there's enough pins on the FPGA, and you notice on the FPGA, some of the inputs have the little clock nomenclature on them, and some of them don't.
Yes.
Well, the FPGA has certain inputs that are dedicated to clock inputs, so we make sure to hook those pins that I've annotated there, hook those to clock inputs on the FPGA. And that way we can feed them into PLLs and do all kind of funky things with them. But they're special low latency from the pin to the global clock nets inside. And there's 8 global clock nets inside, I believe, either 8 or 16 in this FPGA. So you can program the FPGA and pick whichever clock or clocks you want to use. So the idea is, if we can use this MEC80 connector, it's just gold edge fingers. So it's basically cost nothing to put it on the board except for space. Hook it up to some extra pins on the FPGA. Then when I get a DE board, I can plug an HF1 or HF2 right on it, and I immediately have a debug case with receiver hardware.
Okay, very good. So let me understand. On the DE board, it has the actual connector, the MEC connector soldered on, or is the MEC connector soldered onto the RF module?
The MEC connector's on the HF1 or HF2. It's just gold fingers, edge fingers on our board. And then the connector itself is on the HF1. And on the HF2, there's actually two of them. And you plug the HF2 onto the MEC on the data engine, and then you plug the transmitter board into the receiver board, and then you have a transceiver.
Okay, I was thinking about Tangerine. Do you have the plastic connector housing attached to the DE board?
No, the plastic connector is attached to the RF modules.
Okay, I was trying to figure out how that works then. So the DE has gold edge fingers on it?
Correct, and so there'll be two sets of those along the bottom edge, anticipating the board will be 100 by 100 millimeters, and the connectors are about, they're like 39 millimeters and change, so about 40 millimeters. So we can put two of them along the bottom edge of the board, and then we'll put the DE, connect the DE, the, pardon me, the MEC 80 pin connector is the little one over to the left on my diagram that takes the HF1 and HF2. That is a narrower connector. We can put that around the corner on the side, and it again is gold fingers. So you have gold fingers, two sets facing down and one set facing, say, to the right.
Okay. So the question then is, mechanically, how do you mount, or how do you attach the RF module so that it's mechanically, held to the DE board?
So you're going to plug the RF module, each one of them, so they're going to be, let's say they're going to be 48 millimeters wide by 100 millimeters long. So they're a little bit bigger than the old RF modules that we were talking about earlier. They're going to mount parallel to the data engine underneath it. So they're basically, the connector is going to fold the DE back underneath. So when you plug the two RF boards in, you'll have a double stack, the two RF modules on the bottom and the DE board above it. And then we're going to put a spacer on the far end to hold the board out, and it's about 2.3 millimeters, I think, is the distance between the two boards. And then we're going to make the RF modules long enough that we can put the SMAs out the far end.
Okay. Yeah, I'm still confused. Maybe you just need to update the drawings, and then we can discuss that later. I'm just trying to figure out, where the screws and the standoffs and things go so that it's mechanically rigid.
Yeah, so the idea would be each RF board, RF module would be held in place with the MEC-140 at one end, and at the other end, about three quarters of the way up, you just have a hole, and then there'd be a standoff to the DE, and you put a screw in. We use a threaded standoff and solder it to the data engine on the bottom of the board. So you'd plug the board in and then put a screw through it into the threaded standoff, and you'd have a two-point mounting.
Okay, very good. Some connectors can't tolerate, mechanical vibration or vertical loading on a connector like that, but others can. So I don't know the MEC connector and what it's capable of.
Yeah, and I know on the IQ2, where we actually mount the data engine, which is a CVA-9 board, and the HF2 together, we mount them both on standoffs. And I think I use four standoffs for the data engine, and I use only two additional standoffs for the MEC, for the HF2 board. So the MEC connector actually does hold up one end of the board, and it's pretty robust.
Okay, well, that's good. I remember seeing some cautions in some of the connectors. Maybe it was the M.2. where you couldn't really put any lateral loading on the connector.
Yeah, on the M.2, you must hold it down to the board because it goes in kind of like a DIMM module. It goes in at an angle, and then the actual pushing the plug-in board down parallel to the baseboard is what actually produces the pressure on the contacts. So you have to hold the board in that position, otherwise it won't work.
Okay, very good. So I think I understand now. So the screw will hold the other end of the board out. If we do run into any problems, we could always put on some plastic card guides and beef up the mechanics.
Yeah, or maybe I'm going to do the mock-up, And I'm going to actually put some SMAs on, and I'm going to mount all the connectors on, and then we'll plug it together and see what it looks like. We might end up having to put like two spacers, you know, one on each side, because we are going to have SMAs coming off the far end. So you're going to want to, I mean, there's going to be cables up to those, so you're going to want to keep the board pretty steady. Maybe one spacer isn't enough.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think the seeing the mock-up will probably be worth about four TeamSpeak sessions.
Yeah, really. I'm just hoping I can get it to work, because it's going to be a lot of filing and cutting. But I'm going to use copper clad, double-sided, so I can just solder the connector pins all down, and the connectors will be easy to put on. I bought all surface mount connectors, and I'm using end launch SMAs. Have you ever used those before?
Oh yeah, those are most development boards you see use those nowadays.
Okay, so we can use those, and if we put them on the backside, my concern is that since they're going to be underneath the Raspberry Pi header, if we make that a through-hole header, which I kind of like to do, then I've got pins on the back sticking through, and I may have clearance issues there, so we might have to make the RF modules a little bit longer to get the SMAs out from under the DE.
Okay, yeah, I think I see what you're saying. Yeah, the end launch ones are pretty, those are pretty stout connectors.
Yeah, and if you put them so that the center pin is on the back of the board, they don't require much clearance, right?
Yeah, there's a couple of styles of the launchers. There's the kind that have, you know, four pins, and you solder two of the ground pins to the board, you solder the center conductor, and then you have two ground pins kind of floating out in outer space. And then there's some versions of that connector where those two extra ground lugs are missing, and the ground lugs that solder the board are bifurcated and actually slip over and solder on both sides of the board.
Yeah, those are the ones I'm talking about using.
Okay, yeah, I like those. Those are real good. They're mechanically indestructible.
Yeah, and so how much do I only have like 2.5 millimeters. 2.3 millimeters space between the boards. So if you stick up more than that, and you have to subtract the amount that a male header will stick through the upper board. So I don't know, we may end up having to just extend the boards or use a surface mount header on the top of the DE, then there's no holes at all.
Okay, that sounds real good. I tried to model your proposed alternate approach, but I don't know how to make the transmission line model and spice behave itself.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I see Steve still has his set up for Vox. So I guess I see the 2-ohm shunt on the clock is not going to work. That's even 22 ohms would be iffy, I think. I'm not sure why it doesn't show up in your simulation. And, you know, with the new clocking scheme that I just put forward on this diagram, I don't think every clock is point to point, and there's no stubs, and there's no driving off buffers or anything like that. So I think that's probably the best way. It increases the cost a little bit because we got to come up with that blank bypass board. But realistically, that's only a 2-layer board. It's going to have to be long enough to reach the mounting screw because it goes into an M.2 connector. But other than that, there's no components on it.
Yeah, that should be pretty inexpensive. I think your approach here looks pretty good. I'll be interested in seeing the mechanics. So I think you're off to a real good start there. Yeah, no, the problem I was having with SPICE was unbelievability. Not the impact of the connector impedance. It just, the model wasn't doing the right thing at all. So it was just producing kind of utter nonsense.
Well, it showed that shunt 7-puff was having no effect at all, right?
It was worse than that. Where the two transmission, I had a transmission line, a shunt 7-puff capacitor, a second transmission line, and then a load. And the connection between the two transmission lines where the 7-puff shunt is, there was no voltage of any kind. It was 0.00000 volts for all time. And yet the input to the first transmission line was being excited, and the output of the second transmission line was responding. And I don't know how that can happen if the connection between the two transmission lines has no movement or voltage change of any kind.
Well, is it possible it's an exact quarter wave, so you get a voltage null at the end of the transmission line?
No. The lengths and the edge rates were such that that wouldn't happen. And secondly, I'm putting in a pulse, which is a wideband signal, and so it's only a quarter wave at one frequency. So the actual SPICE model, I don't believe what it's not that it's too good. It's just something is completely dead wrong.
It's perfect, so that's impossible.
No, it's not. It's not that it's perfect. There is no pulse. You can't see any signal, not noise or corruption. There's a signal going into the first transmission line. There's that signal coming out of the second one, but that pulse doesn't exist in between the two. That's impossible.
Yeah, so that's something's wrong. Yeah, you're right. So, okay, that's a task for another day, I guess, to figure out what's wrong with that. But I did have a question on the clock module pinout that you had come up with. You have two stat zero outputs, a couple of differential pairs. What are those used for?
Hang on, I'm going to have to bring up the diagram. Hang on.
Yeah, because you've got the ID I2C and a SPI I2C and the connection for the DAC for steering the clock. Those are all separate, but these are just down there, and it doesn't really say what they are.
Okay, I've got the ICD for the clock up. Okay, yeah, clock M stat. Let me see. I left those. I think there's a description somewhere. I left those in case we needed any high-speed status output, and so they're probably unused right now. But I left them there just in case we needed something that had to come out that would be in the 100 megahertz range that was a status bit.
Or maybe like an out-of-lock indicator?
It could be used for almost anything, but an out-of-lock indicator would be a good one.
Okay, because yeah, I looked over all the pinouts you had there, and except for those which I didn't know what they were for, I think there's enough pins there to do everything that I need to do. I may want to add, I don't know if you had a VCO steering pin, an analog VCO steering pin, in case we wanted to, say we wanted to make a clock module with a CVHD 950, you know, the clock module we used on the Hermes, and we wanted to steer it using an analog output from the FPGA. Of course, maybe we don't want to do that, but an extra pin would be usable, and I think we have 6 or 8 extra pins.
Yeah, there's a bunch. I left all the pins above. Okay, well, seems like something locked up here. I left all the pins above the key unassigned, so that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I left 9 pins unassigned on the other side of the M key. Typically, running VCO control voltages across connectors is not a good thing, because that's any millivolts of noise can cause megahertz of signal wandering.
Well, if you're trimming the CVHD, you only get about 300 parts per million full scale, so it's not that bad. But yeah, noise would be bad.
Okay. Yeah. It depends. If you use a VCO that's not crystal controlled, nanovolts cause problems. A crystal controlled one will be a lot better behaved, but typically that particular path, I remember many a modules where we ended up having to solder metal shields over the VCO control line so that it was completely shielded from anything. But maybe it's not that much of an issue in this case.
Well, so then maybe it'd be a better idea to use the, in the case of a non-GPSDO clock module, to take the 3 SPI pins that would normally go to the DAC that would tune the VCO and put a DAC on there and use it to tune the VCO and make it digitally controlled.
That would be cleaner from RF point of view, without knowing the sensitivity of the VCXO. You know, it may be that it's unimportant, or we don't need to. But it's nice to have both options available.
Yeah, so maybe we ought to put an analog pin on there just for a low performance case.
Okay, tell me where you want to put it. Having those nice unassigned pins out beyond the key is probably good, because then it won't pick up crosstalk as easily from any of the other connector pins.
Yeah, we could put it at the end with the ground on either side and isolate it.
That sounds like a good approach.
Okay, the only other thing that I've been talking with my business partner here about, since we're both SDR guys, we spend our lunch hour talking about stuff like this. The question is, how would we do this if we had multiple data engines with, say, for instance, we had an RF module that is a single 16-bit ADC. So we'd outfit two data engines with two RF modules each. So we'd have four channels, and we want to synchronize all of them. And I guess I'll just leave the question like that, because you have to synchronize the oscillators, and then you have to synchronize the FPGAs on the two data engines. And this is something that we were never really able to do well on Hermes.
Okay, I'm trying to bring that back up. The clock module, you can lock the oscillator outputs on the synthesizer to the same input, so that four oscillator outputs coming out of the clock module can all be phase aligned and locked to each other. And so you can at least assure that you have pretty good coherence between the 122.88 clocks going to the two receivers. Does that answer the question?
Well, that answers part of it, but I kind of knew that part, because we can synchronize the two RF modules on the same DE. Now, suppose you want to lock the clocks on two DEs that have two different clock modules. So we could take a 10 megahertz clock input, a reference input, and feed it to both clock modules and have it lock the onboard oscillator to the 10 megahertz, and then generate four clocks that are all coherent with each other. And would that give us enough coherence to basically generate eight clocks that would be coherent?
Oh, gosh, I don't know about that. There's a couple of spare oscillator outputs on the clock module. You could feed the output of one over to the input of the other. I think there is a clock follower mode in the synthesizer. I'll have to look at that. So you might be able to take one of the high speed clocks out of one clock module, run it over to the input of the other clock module, and then program the synthesizer to be in the clock follower mode.
But is it a program delay? So you could actually make it like a zero delay buffer by delaying, because you're obviously going to have a delay through the second clock chip. So if you can make the delay 3/4 of a clock, you might be able to still line the outputs up.
Yeah, I think it has a mode where you can make it on the follower mode, the output will follow the input with no time delay. But then, of course, you do have some time delay from the other, from the cable that interconnects them. I don't think that's a problem, actually. If you have the two RF modules on one DE board, you know, a nanosecond or two or three or five nanoseconds behind the clock modules on the other board, I don't think that's actually a problem.
Well, as long as it's a fixed phase delay and it doesn't jitter around. So if the clock's later and all the signals are later and everything's still synchronized, you're okay. But now we're talking about running the FPGAs in lockstep. So again, they could be a clock out or two clocks out or three clocks out from each other, as long as they stay three clocks out from each other and they don't slip a cog, so to speak.
Yeah. I suspect the clock follower will add a little bit of jitter to the clock. So the receiver sensitivity might be slightly different on receivers number three and four from receivers one and two. But I don't know. I haven't characterized the synthesizer and how it works that way. But yeah, as long as it doesn't, you know, as long as the phase difference is constant, it doesn't matter, because you can calibrate all of that out.
Okay, so then what I'm thinking is you would use a different clock module, because you're not going to want to use a GPSDO to do this. So we may have a clock module that is specifically designed for expansion so that you can link multiple DEs together. And so would it be possible then to have a reference input on the clock module and lock all four outputs to that, So basically you could have like one of John Ackerman's clock distribution amps that would feed 10 megahertz to each of four DEs, and they would all be phase locked to that 10 megahertz, and you basically get a stable system like that.
Yeah, I think that there's that input is already defined on the clock module ICD.
Okay, so, but of course, we'd have to make sure whatever clock module we built that doesn't have a GPS on it would still have that phase lock input, the ability to, that reference input that we could phase lock to, right?
Yeah, yeah. I left a pin, and on the block diagram for the clock module in the requirements document, I put that input there.
Okay, so perfect. So that means we can synchronize the clock. Now that that's all handled, how do we synchronize the FPGAs? And you know, my first thought was basically you'd have a reference clock reference input, and then you would have a reset input, and the reset input would have to be synchronized with the clock, and then you could synchronously reset each of the four. Say you had four, you reset the four FPGAs.
Okay, I haven't played with FPGAs, so I don't know how you lock two FPGAs together. First question, do they need to be synchronized?
They don't need to be synchronized. Well, yes, they do need to be synchronized, but they don't have to be synchronized with zero phase offset. So if one was synchronized, you know, one clock later or two clocks later or three clocks later than the other, that's okay. However, when you're synchronizing them, you can't feed a reset pulse to it and miss the setup and hold times, because then you get meta stability and you get one or the other. And in actuality, I think that still works, because it'll go meta stable, then you'll either get one or you'll get two. But once it locks, then it'll stay one clock off or two clocks off. So I guess that means it's not as critical as I'm thinking it is.
Okay, the next question. You're going to need a pulse per second pulse input to each FPGA?
Only if you're doing something that needs GPS precision. I'm just thinking of in the case of this was on the HPSDR when people would plug four Mercury boards into their chassis and they want to run them in synchronized. And the problem is that the external clock was an LVDS point-to-point clock or a PECL. And so you really couldn't have one Mercury board sourcing the clock for the other three, because you couldn't really go do a 1-to-3. Well, they ended up doing a 1-to-3 and it sort of worked, but they never could get the FPGAs to stay in lockstep. I think they got the clocks to come in at some odd skew to each other.
Okay, understand. Yeah, I was just thinking if you need to timestamp stuff, you've got to worry about duplicating PPS. If you don't need to timestamp, then of course that problem goes away.
But if you need PPS on each one, you could generate a separate PPS from each one would have a GPS. And so theoretically, the GPSs, the four GPSs that you have sitting on the same table would be very close to each other then, wouldn't they, in time?
Well, okay. Yeah, they would. But then I thought the purpose here was to have a clock follower so you could avoid having a second GPS.
Yeah, and actually, I never really thought about a GPS. I'm just thinking of the crude system where you have four Mercury boards and you want to have, a diversity receiver with four channels or eight channels or 16 channels or however many you want.
Okay, well, I would probably need a diagram to understand that.
Well, maybe at DCC we can go over it, because it sounds like a face-to-face back of a napkin kind of thing to understand it.
Okay, really good. Hey, I had one. I don't think we have any of our scientist friends on tonight. Well, maybe we do. There was one comment on the receiver one about the noise source, and there was a bunch of comments about why we need a noise source on the receiver, and there's a bunch of science reasons why it's needed. But one of them is they wanted to switch the noise source on and off at about a 1 kilohertz rate. And I was looking initially at relays on the receiver, which of course probably, you know, you probably wouldn't handle that kind of switching speed.
So did they say why they needed it to be switched on and off at that speed?
Well, they wanted to, they referenced the paper where they could look at some kind of background noise. And by chopping it on and off, I think they get something like you know, like you get with a chopper amplifier. I haven't read the paper, so I could be completely out in outer space here. But you get a synchronous signal, noise, no noise, noise, no noise, kind of like at a kilohertz rate. And you can use that chopping action to more accurately detect the background noise level.
So I can comment about this.
Steve.
So, a couple of things. One, I heard the conversation you guys were having about the clocks or whatever. And I think if you want to do anything that would involve phase coherency and time tagging, it probably, I don't know better, but I do think it would be better if everything was on one clock instead of multiple GPS clocks, because you could envision a situation where it might be close, but not exactly on. So I just want to kind of comment there. With respect to the noise source stuff that you guys are talking about, this was all Phil. So Phil's the main guy to talk with about some of this stuff. He's the one who brought up a lot of this and wanting to take background noise measurements, because apparently they're not actually very good measurements of background HF noise. So I think that was one of the ideas. And the concept of chopping it the way that it was some kind of Dickey switch. So named after a radio astronomer named Dickey, I think that was some sort of technique he had devised. So I'm going to kind of say Phil's the guy to kind of talk with about this, but at least I can point you to the right person, hopefully.
Okay. It brought up the question. The nice thing about relays, of course, is their third order intermod performance is pretty outstanding, and they're fairly inexpensive. I tried to find some electronic switching mechanism that would work. And of course, PIN diodes are the obvious solution. But the problem with PIN diodes is that when you get below about 2 megahertz, they stop behaving like PIN diodes. And so if we have a lot of AM broadcast coming in on a receiver, my fear is that an electronic switch is going to cause all kinds of third order intermod problems on the receiver.
Yeah, so I have a suggestion, and maybe what we can try is we can use a relay to hook the noise source up to the input. And then what we can do is we can use a FAT or some other active device to modulate it, to turn it on and off. So the idea would be is that you wouldn't have to put up with the IM distortion all the time. You don't have to put up with it while you're testing. Well, there's probably going to be pretty much controlled environment while you're doing that. So what you do is you'd turn the relay on, then you'd run your oscillator at 1 kilohertz and you make your measurement, and then you turn the relay off and it would be completely disconnected. So the relay would, you know, have a very low duty cycle, and the high speed switching would be done with a switch. But the problem with that is when the relay is engaged, you may get some bleed through of the MOSFET, of the noise on the MOSFET. So you may increase the noise floor just by closing the relay.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying. I think they wanted to do long-term measurements, you know, of galactic noise or something like that, where they would have this noise source chopping it at kilohertz for, you know, long, long periods of time, and while there was low megahertz RF coming in. So I'm not sure it's only test. I think it may actually be measurement.
But if that's the case, then you're not going to be measuring anything else while you're doing that test, right?
Well, I think they actually, it's on for a millisecond, and you're measuring, you're measuring just the noise source, and then it's off for a millisecond, and you're just measuring the receiver, and then it's back on, and you're measuring just the noise source, but that runs for, you know, a long period of time.
Okay, so if the turning the relay on were to degrade the noise on the input, turning the relay on and turning the noise source off would still degrade the signal to noise ratio of the receiver, they might be able to live with just a few dB of degradation.
Well, they wanted to leave the noise source on continuously rather than turning the noise on and off, because they're worried about thermal drift in the noise diode.
I'd be more worried about picking up noise everywhere.
I don't think that's as much an issue. A relay in the HF region is going to have, 70, 80 dB of isolation, and the noise source is going to have maybe 5 dB of excess noise ratio, or, you know, at the outside maybe 10. So the leakage of the noise source through the relay would be, you know, like 50 dB below thermal noise.
Oh, I see. So the noise floor of the receiver is minus 145, then the noise would, the noise signal would be minus 140. So if you, okay, well, if that's the case, then shouldn't you be able to build a solid state circuit that gives you, you know, 20 dB of isolation? That would be enough.
Well, yeah, the problem is that you have to switch the receiver on and off, and that electronic switch is connected in the receiver path for some period of time, and then it's going to impact the third order intermod performance of the receiver.
Well, suppose you leave the antenna connected, and I mean, is anybody going to complain when you transmit it at minus 140 dBm?
That's not the problem. The problem is if the receiver is receiving a couple of strong AM broadcast stations, they are going to intermodulate themselves in any electronic switch and produce all kinds of spurs in the received signal output.
I see. So yeah, this is the reason why they used a relay on the Mercury board, because they, all those parts in line generate intermod.
Yeah, yeah. So the relay contacts are really good. They don't generate third order intermod or any, or at any level that we would care about. So I may have to discuss that with Phil. Maybe Phil knows about some kind of electronic switch technology. Like I said, the switch that can provide the good intermod performance is a pin, but you know, you have to keep that up above several megahertz or it doesn't work, because pin diodes stop being pin diodes below about 2 megahertz.
Well, and you know, if we're doing this, depending on what frequency we're doing this at, the noise at the antenna is way higher than the noise floor of the receiver. So couldn't you theoretically put an attenuator in line to get rid of those pesky IMD generating signals?
Well, there was some comments where some of the folks wanted even better receive sensitivity. And I don't think where we're sitting now is at 30 megahertz. I think the cosmic background noise is about 15 dB above thermal noise. And so I don't think we want to put preamps on the receiver, because there's an entirely new raft of problems. But I don't think we're going to need it. I measured Hermes with my 5 dB ENR, and I was able to detect the 5 dB ENR source even through an Alex module.
Oh, okay. And that noise source is what, a broadband?
Yeah, the noise source is a Zener diode fed with a 10 milliamp constant current source, and then it goes through a resistive attenuator to bring it down, because the Zener diode puts out too much excess noise. So the particular one's got a resistive pad, and it takes it down to 5 dB ENR. I ran that into my Hermes Alex combination, and I got 1.7 dB of noise increase when I turned on the 5 dB ENR. So that computes out to about 8.2 or 8.3 dB noise figure. I estimated 6.5 dB for Hermes. And then you know, when you go to Alex, you've got a relay to select which low pass filter in Alex. Then you've got a relay on the other side of the low pass filter. Then you've got a relay to select the receive only or the transmit antenna. Then you've got another relay to select which receive antenna. So in Alex, the receive signal is going through 4 relays and a low-pass filter before it gets to Hermes. And so my estimate is that we're losing about 1.5 dB going through Alex before it gets to Hermes. So the 6.5 dB noise figure that I estimated for Hermes goes up to 8-something when you go through the Alex module. And yet, even with all of that, I was still seeing the noise from the 5 dB ENR, and that's without any, and that's just the normal stock Hermes, so I don't think there's a preamp on Hermes.
There's only a 6-meter preamp on the Alex boards, and there actually is a preamp on the Hermes and an attenuator. The preamps on is a 20 dB preamps on all the time. And then there's either 10 or 20 dB attenuator. So when you kick in the 20 dB attenuator, the net result is zero.
Yeah, that preamp is the 20 dB gain of the ADC driver, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's an ADC preamp. So it's designed to drive the ADC, but also provide you 20 dB of gain. And then we put the attenuator ahead of it.
Right, right. So that's where I was. So the noise figure of that ADC driver that has 20 dB of gain, its noise figure is 6.0 dB. And I figured we lost a half a dB going through attenuator and, you know, a antenna connector and stuff like that. That's where I estimated 6.5 dB of noise figure.
Okay, it sounds like it's a pretty good estimate.
Yeah, seems to be pretty close. So I'm going to rewrite the spec. Folks saw the, you know, estimating man-made noise, and I think I'm just going to take all of that out and say the requirement for the receiver is X dB noise figure or better.
Yeah, that's a good idea. But then is that going to be sufficient? Because they were clamoring for more gain, but I don't think that's going to do anything.
Well, I think in fact it won't, because right now we can already see the noise from a 5 dB over thermal noise source. And at 30 megahertz, the cosmic noise is 15 dB over thermal noise.
Okay. Makes perfect sense then. So then the only question is, how are we going to be able to modulate this at a kilohertz without interfering with the normal operation of the receiver?
Yeah, exactly. And that's in my background. I don't know the kind of switches that you can find that can switch that fast and have the good third order intermod performance and work down below a megahertz where there's some interesting physics to be done. So it's kind of a three-dimensional problem, and we're going to need to find somebody who's an expert in that area and the solution of which doesn't cost a lot of money.
Yeah, I wonder if Lyle could help in that area. Do you have something to say, Dave?
Oh, I was just going to say, it's not a serious suggestion, but years ago I remember following an interferometer design that used a Dickey switch configuration to subtract out, the thermal background or something. And it used this may have been in the 80s, a hybrid ceramic dipped hybrid monstrosity that was apparently, and I bought one of these, a replacement generator for the square wave from a used by a Hammond B3 organ to generate the various, I don't know what they call them, gear wheel signals or something. And it was just a curiosity.
Oh, that would be neat. You know, you've heard of these ionospheric whistlers. We could have Leslie's on the whistlers.
But are you talking about a top octave generator?
This was the original. The original Hammond B3s used opto interrupted gear chains to generate the fundamentals that they combined. I'm not quite sure, this was kind of an electronic replacement from the 60s or 70s.
Now the question. The question for you, Dave, is can you find that part?
That's a big question. This was a long time ago, but it was a curious-looking thing.
Yeah, I just looked up on the SETI League website, and that's exactly what they do with the Dickey switch. They chop the noise source at about a kilohertz, and what they're looking for is the difference in noise level between the externally received noise and the internally received noise, and they look at it in the millisecond time frame to make sure that there's, you know, they're not seeing any drift from the receiver or the noise source. But I haven't found the schematic of the device.
Well, hey, we're an SDR, right? Why don't we just hook a DAC up there and generate our own noise waveform?
Well, there you go. This may be a nice to have, but we have to figure, you know, if we can't accomplish it in a couple of dollars, it may have to go to phase two.
Well, is this the kind of thing that you could actually build externally and just hook to the antenna input?
Yeah, it would have to have its own noise source, its own switch, etc. Of course, it would run into the same set of problems there about third order intermod, but maybe it would be done in a frequency range such that, you know, people aren't interested in what's happening down in the AM band.
Well, and I guess the other thing that you could do is if the 1 kilohertz did not have to be synchronized with anything, then you could make it a standalone box and you could go to town with, you know, spend a little bit more money on it if that was important.
Okay. Well, that's a good point. If we need if it's a use case that one person is using, you know, we might suggest it be external in order to avoid having that cost on the other 1,000 users.
Well, I don't want to just abandon it out of hand, but if it's going to be expensive or bulky or not work right, then maybe we ought to consider that as an option.
Yeah, we'd need to find somebody who knows the technology here and can advise us.
I think DCC's coming up. It's going to be a good opportunity. So maybe we ought to be making a list of things to talk about at DCC.
Ah, okay. Well, that brings up another one of the questions that came, and that was cost objectives. I had TBD on the receiver cost, and the answer was, I think the reviewers are looking for the sum of the data engine plus the receiver module cost for the cost target, and I don't know what the data engine cost is.
Well, I'm shooting for $200 on the data engine, and my thought was $150 on the RF module. Is that in the ballpark, or is it too little?
Well, yeah, we the request was for $300 for what I interpret as the sum of those two. That doesn't include the clock module or the magnetometer or anything. So I interpret it as the receiver plus the DE, and we had originally specified a $300 target about a year ago, and that was reiterated in the comments.
Okay, yeah, and the way I do the estimate is I add up the BOM cost and estimate the cost of the PC board. And then I multiply by 2 to 3 times. And that gives you assembly cost, test cost, marketing cost, and sales overhead. And depending on how you sell it, you know, 2 to 3 times is a, and you can go up to 4 times if you want to get extravagant, but you know, Tapper's a low buck outfit. So 2 to 3 times ought to do it for us.
Well, yeah, yeah. When we did the original estimate, I think we were looking at parts cost, but, the commenters didn't specify whether they were talking about price or cost. And so I'll have to say, I don't know the answer right now. Probably that's another good DCC discussion.
Yeah, I was talking about price. So sales price of 3X on the high end and 2X on the low end from the BOM cost. But you have to include the PC board. And like for the data engine, it's not going to be cheap because it's probably going to be at least an 8-layer board.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, those are good questions to have. You and I can talk about that at DCC, but we're going to have to fairly soon start to put together some cost estimates, I think.
Yeah, and I've already done that for the bomb cost, but it's like dancing on quicksand, you know, because things are changing and you have to continually modify it to get an up-to-date number. So we'll have a good snapshot, I think, at DCC, and I think I'm pretty close. One of the things I wanted to ask the group here is I originally had a real-time clock chip on the DC on the DE, and I subsequently took it off because I figured any low-cost SBC or reasonably performant SBC is going to have a real-time clock, and likely if we have a GPSDO, aren't we going to end up making our own real-time clock / counter inside the FPGA?
Well, yeah, if you have a GPS module, then over the I think it's the SPI interface, you'll have you'll need to have accurate GPS time in the FPGA. So I would think a clock, real-time clock, would only be needed for the case where there's no GPS module.
And in that case, you could take it from I2S across an I2S bus from the single board computer.
Yeah, so it may be a possibility to do that. Let me see. Gosh, there was another question at the top of my mind from the comments. My brain is getting old. It just fell out the other end.
Oh no, I hate it when that happens. But the clock, to get rid of the clock was a good deal because between the clock and the socket and the battery, it was about $11 or $12 worth of BOM cost. So that's a good thing to eliminate if you don't need it.
Yeah, I don't see where, you know, there may be other use cases I'm not thinking of. My use case focus here is only on one or two, but it seems like you would have good enough clock from the SBC when there's no GPS, and when you need the super accurate, you'd have the GPS anyway.
Yeah, okay. And the other part that I am dodging on, I can put an 80-cent temperature sensor on the board, but there is a temperature sensor in the FPGA already. So I'm thinking, but the FPGA one is kind of convoluted to read. whereas the 80 cent one is an I2C one that you can read real easily. But, you know, I really am trying to avoid the creeping elegance syndrome and adding stuff in that we don't need.
Yeah, particularly since, okay, I remember what fell out of my brain here. Yeah, the cost is, you know, we're going to have to weigh everything with cost because, you know, folks are looking at other modules in the $300 price range that are missing a whole ton of features. And if we end up comparing a hugely feature-laden expensive receiver against a fairly cheap non-laden receiver, I don't think we're going to do folks a lot of good. Question was, can we put a hardware unique serial number on each and every receiver?
We got a hardware unique serial number on every DE board. We can put that. I believe we could put it in the, in fact, here's what we do. See, now that's not going to work. I was going to say, we've got a writable ROM that could be writable in manufacturing on each RF board. So maybe we pick that chip that has a built-in serial number. They do make them like that. But what I really need is I need a scratch pad location of like 100 bytes that or 1K bytes that we can write the description of the board in it, and then an area that has a unique serial number that you cannot change.
Yeah, so the question was if we could do that. And I replied in the comments, you know, it's possible to do it, but I don't know what the manufacturing implications are.
Well, I think we can include that with the ID channel, the I2C ID channel.
Yeah, that's where I thought it would put it. You know, the ID says, you know, hey, this is an RF M5001D module, you know, so that the FPGA knows how to configure itself. And you would put the serial number in that same PROM, but I didn't know, you know, how, you know, what the manufacturing implications are for getting a serial number into that PROM.
Well, this is another kind of a related question is, we're going to have an Ethernet PHY on this board, right? We're going to have Ethernet MAC on this board. So we're going to have an Ethernet MAC address. And since my goal here is my subterfuge goal here is to be able to plug many of these on one network, we can't just program 0123456 into the MAC address.
Yeah, so yeah, that's a point. So you need a MAC address on the DE's ident PROM, and you need some other equivalent function, doesn't have to be an Ethernet ID, but a serial number in the PROM on the receiver. So it's kind of a generic problem.
Yeah, and so I have the MAC address problem solved because at work we paid, I forget how much we paid, but we got like a block of 16 million MAC addresses. So we can just whittle off a few and assign them to Tapper, and we'll have unique MAC addresses on every board. And then one of the parts that I have planned for the board has a unique serial number already on the DE, but we have to figure out a way to do that on the RF board also, right?
Yeah, right. So I didn't know, you know, to me it's a manufacturing issue. You've got a PROM and you have to burn it, you know, you either burn it, then you solder it on the board. I don't think that's desirable. I think you want to solder the PROM on the board on the surface mount line. And then you have to program that PROM after it's already soldered on the board.
Yeah, the chips that I'm using come pre-programmed read-only with a unique number. They won't guarantee you what the number is. They just guarantee you that it's a 64-bit unique number, unique from every other chip made that has the serial number in it.
Okay, but you also need information that's the ID that says this is an RFM5001D.
Correct, and we're going to program that in, and then you can either make it one-time programmable, maybe, or you can, I don't know how we're going to do it, but we'll find a way to do that in manufacturing. Like you said, it's a manufacturing issue, but I would rather make that particular setup read only so that the user can't change it, because it's supposed to identify what the hardware is, so it shouldn't be changeable.
Yeah, they make these thing called write once PROMs. Can you use those?
Yep, we certainly can, and that's probably the best way.
Okay, I don't know what the cost and availability and I2C and all of that stuff is for those parts.
Well, the part that we're using on the data engine, I stole that mercilessly from the Lime Mini SDR, and it is about 80 cents, And it will actually store RSA keys in it also, as well as giving you a 64-bit serial number.
Okay, so it sounds like that may end up not being an issue. That would be excellent.
Yeah, and even if we end up having two separate I2C PROMs, the two different addresses, and one for the fixed portion and one for the variable portion, which we will make fixed because we will rig it so that you can't program it on the board, then well, that would work too, wouldn't it? As long as you read it with the same two hardware lines.
Yeah, the key is, you know, we are out of address pin. We are out of pins of any kind on the receiver. And so those I2C pins, they go to the ident PROM. You know, we stole and borrowed the SPI lines as I2C other lines, and then we have to go through all the chip select decodes. We'd have to go in there and put in a ton of logic to handle that.
Well, hopefully you don't have to put in any logic on the simple boards, right?
I don't know. I think we do, because the attenuators don't have any decoding logic. And so I think we're going to end up having to decode the chip selects.
But we have three of them, right? So you can feed one to each attenuator and one to the ADC.
Nope. There is a fourth one that we need.
Oh, no. What's the fourth one?
Hang on. I got to pull up the documentation.
Oh, and the other thing I wanted to add to the receiver, I want to steal a ground pin away and put a reset line on the receiver connector.
There aren't any signal lines left.
That's why I'm going to steal a ground pin. I'll tell you which one I picked, and you can tell me if you think it'll work or not.
Okay, let me see. Okay, so the four SPI addresses are the ident EPROM, channel 0 attenuator, channel 1 attenuator, and a GPIO bit to turn the noise relays on and off.
What about the ADC? I mean, the ADC, doesn't it have a... Oh, it's a spy port, isn't it?
Yes, it's a spy port, but it has to timeshare that spy port with the I2C port, because it's using the same pins.
Okay, but the I2C port for the ID is two separate pins used for nothing else. The second I2C port has three chip selects, doesn't it? Or is it one of them a spy chip select?
You have to spy chip select. If you're sharing lines with both SPI and I2C, you have to have chip selects that tell the SPI, hey, listen now, or tell I2C, hey, listen now. So I put in a table in the receiver ICD that goes through the decoding of all of those states.
Oh, yuck. So we got three decode inputs and we have four states.
Yes, we have three decode inputs and four states. And so I put in a table, and you have to do logic functionality. It takes a 3-to-8 line decoder to select.
That's disgusting.
Well, you know, there's no more pins left.
Well, you know, we have lots of ground pins. So, you know, we might rethink that and add another chip select, because I don't like having to have a decoder, especially you end up getting glitches out of decoders. But I guess that doesn't matter, because it's going to be synchronous anyway, right?
Well, yeah, the decoder, even if it puts out a glitch, as long as it stables down before you start clocking the I2C clock or the SPI clock, I think it doesn't matter.
Or you could take the three chip selects and you could have one of them be an enable and the other two be 104 decoder, and then you get no glitches.
Yeah, my guess is the glitch is unimportant. But at any rate, we have a lot to talk about at DCC. I'll put this note on, and we're about 15 minutes over schedule here.
Yeah, okay. Did you hear I want to talk about a reset line on the receive connector, see if we can squeeze that in also. So you might put that down as a topic for next month.
I have an unrelated question for Scotty.
Go ahead, Dave.
Is your SDRstick.com site down that you know of? I'm getting no reply from that site.
Yeah, we had a power failure and the machine didn't come back up. I got to go turn it back on.
Okay, I was just wondering if you'd moved that material elsewhere and had lost the setup or something.
Nope. I went to there the other day and I noticed it was down, and it's like, oh, gee, I should fix that. And then it, you know, then, oh, look, a squirrel. And I got off on something else.
Yep. I was looking for it. I found almost everything I needed, but I thought I'd at least report it to you if you hadn't heard of it.
Okay. Anything specific you need that I can send to you?
No. One thing, I was looking for that tiny power plug which you use on the HF2 board. And I found my downloaded copies of the manual, so it was in there.
You want me to bring you one to DCC?
Sure, that would be easy.
Okay, make sure to drop me a note so I won't forget, because you know my brain is like Tom's, you know, the last thing drops off.
Yep, I understand.
Oh, Scotty, one thing. I recorded the 15 minutes of NAQP, and I sent it to my friend in Dallas, who's going to put it in the microwave update seminar package. And it's interesting. It's just a raw IQ. It's not a WAV file. It's just raw IQ produced from GNU Radio. But it was a huge file, 661 meg. And I compressed it with zip, and it compressed down to 236 meg.
Wow, 3-to-1?
Just about 3-to-1. And I think that's lossless compression, so it should be able to be completely losslessly recovered. I'm surprised it compressed that well.
Yeah, zip should be lossless because you can compress programs.
Yeah, so I used 7-zip, but I, you know, it gave it a zip suffix. But I was really surprised that we got 3-to-1. That may be something that Bill Engelty is interested in.
Yeah, really, because WAV files don't compress that much.
Yeah, and, you know, this is basically WAV, you know, so maybe, you know, maybe the amount of compression you get depends on how busy the band is. But during a contest, there's a fair amount of activity. And I was really impressed that it did that well.
Might be interesting to unzip it and play it and see if it's still good.
Yeah, probably ought to do that.
Okay, well, I'm talked out, and I think we're way over anyway. So, anything else?
Oh, we're three weeks away from DCC.
Oh wow! Don't tell me. We got. I think we have 4 students coming.
Outstanding. Where are they from?
Well, we got Christina and Skylar from Case Western. We have Evan from NJIT. We have, I don't remember his name, that Nathaniel's bringing from Scranton. Let's see, that's 4. And then I actually have a guy here from ASU who's second year engineering. He wants to come, so that's 5.
Very good. Very good. So that sounds encouraging. Well, we'll let you run. Take care.